Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm delighted to welcome back into our studios Nancy Matthews, a good friend of WGTD and The Morning Show. She has been on the program any number of times and at least once a year for quite a few years now, talking about an event that is near and dear to her heart, the Pike River Rendezvous. And this is the 20th Pike River Rendezvous, which is occurring this Saturday and Sunday. Nancy is Director of Interpretation at the Kenosha Public Museum. Before that, she was the Senior Curator of Education. With her is Mike Elam, who is one of the participants in the Pike River Rendezvous, and someone who cares deeply about this event and works tirelessly behind the scenes to help make it all come true. And this is an event that is free, open to the public, and an event that takes us back in history in a very, very vivid and amazing way. And so I'm glad we can have this opportunity to reconnect and help the Pike River Rendezvous celebrate its 20th anniversary. Nancy Matthews and Mike Elam, we welcome both of you back to The Morning Show. Whoops, there we go. Say it again.
Great. Thanks, Greg.
All right. Now that you're on, it's good to have all of you here. Nancy, before we talk about the Pike River Rendezvous, can you please elaborate on this mysterious title which now adorns your name tag? And I think at least as of last year, you were already Director of Interpretation. But I think a lot of people are going to see that and wonder what that's all about.
And I get that all the time. In the museum field, we use the term interpretation for how we interpret our collections for the general public, whether it's in programming or whether it's in exhibits. So as the Director of Interpretation, I work with the staff in the education collections and exhibit departments to plan out all of the programming and all of the exhibits for all three of our museums, because we are the Kenosha Public Museums. So that's the Kenosha Public Museum Singular, which is our Art, Anthropology, and Natural Sciences Museum, the Dinosaur Discovery Museum, and the Civil War Museum.
Right. So you're part of all of that. So in some ways, we could call you the, among other things, like the Director of Explanation.
Explanation and experience. How's
right,
that?
Right, right. Or that we expound, we expand upon. In other words, a museum is not just walking through a building and looking at what's there. But
Exactly. We want to engage visitors and help them have not only an educational experience, but hopefully a fun experience. And many times people will come through with family members or friends. So it's also a social experience for many people as well.
Absolutely. And of course, it just occurs to me that an event like the Pike River Rendezvous, which does not happen within the walls of the museum, is a really interesting example of the way in which the museum's mission has always, to at least some extent, existed outside of its own four walls. And of course, once upon a time, it was just the Kenosha Public Museum, one building,
exactly,
one set of four walls. And of course, now that has changed in a very exciting way. But
Talk
for a moment about how an event like the Pike River Rendezvous folds into the mission and purpose of the museum.
Well, at the Kenosha Public Museum, for those of you who have been there, our first floor permanent exhibit starts about 400 million years ago when this part of the world was actually submerged under a shallow tropical sea. And very quickly, going through time, you end up in the Potawatomi Four Seasons Village of about 1830. And in the village, at that time, the Potawatomi who were living here were trading with than the Americans prior to that, the French and the British, for European produced goods, and hence the fur trade. The fur trade all came about as a result of a fashion craze, really, in England or Europe. And beaver felt hats were all the rage. Everybody had to have one. Well, a hat was a necessity during the 1600s and before that, because you were either out in the field or, you know, outside doing something. And no matter what the weather, you needed a hat to protect you from the sun, from the rain, from the snow. They had completely depleted the population of beaver in Europe. And so as fishermen were exploring the North Atlantic, they gradually made their way over to the North American coast, realized there were people here, and actually came back with beaver pelts. I think it was originally some Spanish fishermen that were up in the North Atlantic off the coast of, I think, Newfoundland, and actually came back with a beaver coat. So that was like, uh-oh. Guess what? There are beaver in North America. So the fur trade is part of that American Indian story that we tell at the Kenosha Public Museum. Plus, we have a replica of a trading post. So we talk a lot about the fur trade and the impact that the fur trade had on the American Indians living in this part of the Midwest.
Since you are celebrating the 20th anniversary of this event, I think it behooves us to look back 20 years and tell the story of how this event was created in the first place. Because, of course, there are all kinds of ways to tell this important story of Wisconsin's own past that would not involve a recreation of that past to this extraordinary scale. Somebody 20 years ago thought that something like this was needed. Who was that, and who approached whom?
At that time, we were approached by the Parks Department to see if we would like to put on an event like this. The idea primarily at that time was to publicize Peoria Park on the north side. There's a huge nature area at that park that nobody in Kenosha knows about. If you mention the park, everybody says, oh, the baseball diamonds, which they have some beautiful diamonds there. But most people didn't realize it's 75-acre nature area. So,
and it's tucked a little bit away, so you don't go right past it. And so if you don't seek it out, you don't really even know it's there.
Right, and they wanted to do an event like this to kind of get people aware of the fact that this park actually exists. And we spent the better part of a year with the Parks Department clearing out an area where we could start the rendezvous. And we began with about 25 camps, which fit nicely into the area. And over the years, we grew. Eventually, we wound up, what were we there, 5 years, I think? And then we moved. We were asked if we would like to move the event to Simmons Island. And we'd about grown to the point where we didn't have enough space to continue getting any bigger in the park. And we moved to Simmons Island to be in conjunction with the tall ships being here. And it's slowly grown over the years. We don't try to expand too quickly. We want to maintain some control over it. We don't want to have 50 new people in there demonstrating something different.
Right. I mean, it's slow, sustainable growth,
yeah,
and that's what's happened.
A couple of three different new people every year.
Right. So 20 years ago, when the city approached the museum, were they thinking about an event like this, or were they just hoping you would create some kind of event in Peoria Park? And was it your idea then that whatever this event should be, it would make sense for it to be what it's turned out to become then, the Pike River Rendezvous?
Well, one of my neighbors, the late Don Lovelace, he knew a number of people in the city. He got interested in the rendezvous and reenactment because he would see me set up my teepee when I would come back from an event. I would set it up in the backyard if we had rain or something, because you have to dry the canvas out before you put it away. And we had talked quite a bit about that. He had just gotten involved in this, and he was the first one that was contacted. He got a hold of myself and Ernie Craik out in Bristol, and we sat down with Todd Ingrill from the Parks Department and developed a plan of here's what we need as far as the city supplying. We needed wood, we needed water, toilets, in order to do this event. And we presented the idea to the Parks Commission, and fortunately for us, there were several members who are big history buffs, so they were behind it from the get-go, as was the museum. And over the years, we've had a fantastic committee that we work with, both from the mayor's office, the Parks Department, Nancy, and the rest of the staff at the museum. They've been behind this event 100%.
And the museum's executive director, Dan Joyce, is a reenactor in his own right. And so he was very much interested, and so the museum kind of got pulled in through Dan, who was the curator of exhibits and collections at the time. And then myself, as curator of education, said, well, why don't you do some educational something? So that's kind of how the museum got pulled into it. And we've come to play a much bigger role at this time, which, I mean, I love the Rendezvous. I've been thrilled to be part of it for 20 years.
At the time that the museum undertook this then, did any of their other big events yet exist? Or was this the first time the museum had ever really created something like an event of this scale outside of its own walls?
Well, the museum didn't really create it. It was the Parks Department,
sure,
City Administration, and then Ernie, Don, and Kathy, and Mike.
Right.
And so the museum kind of got pulled in kind of as this adjunct off to the side. When we moved down to Simmons Island, we did play a much bigger role. Actually, before we moved down to Simmons Island, we started a food concession. So because there were no other food vendors at that time. So I ran the food concession, which I absolutely hated to do. Because it always meant that Saturday night I'd be making another run to the grocery store to get more onions to chop for brats or get more water. And then when we moved down to Simmons Island, the food concession came with us, and we set up in the bathhouse there. And the bathhouse has not been used in many years. Excuse me. So it always meant going down for a couple of days and scrubbing it out and evicting all the spiders that were there so that we could run the food concession out of there. But now we have food vendors that are part of the reenactment organization, and they travel from reenactment to reenactment throughout the Midwest. So I'm glad to be out of the food business and just in the education business at the Rendezvous.
Well, and that's a big enough responsibility as it is.
Oh, exactly.
Well, I'm really glad to get some clarification, and I think you've set me straight, and probably our listeners too, in terms who think of this as a Kenosha Public Museum event first and foremost, and kind of jumped to the conclusion that this was something that the museum conceived on its own once upon a time.
And as much as I'd like to take credit for it for the museum's sake, I cannot do that, because it is truly a function of the city of Kenosha. We rely on Chris Coachman, who coordinates special events for the city. She does a lot of the promotional work for the event. She is kind of our liaison to city administration if there are any hurdles to jump. Also, the Parks Department are instrumental in making sure that all of the reenactors have water and firewood and ice, and the police department are very integral as well in providing security. We have people who are camping out in the city basically from Wednesday until Monday. So they ride through. There's a bike patrol that will ride through and maintain security, and then overnight patrols as well. And, you know, the city or museum staff in the education department, Jen Edgington, who is one of our curators of education, Doug Dahman, who is the manager of the education department. They will both be out there on Saturday. He will be out there this weekend. We have museum volunteers. So it really is not just a museum event, but it's a City of Kenosha event.
For those of you just joining us, we are talking today about the 20th Pike River Rendezvous, which takes place on Simmons Island, on Simmons Island Park, this weekend, Saturday and Sunday. And with us is Nancy Matthews, Director of Interpretation at the Kenosha Public Museum, and Mike Elam, who has been part of this. Both of them have been a big part of this event all the way from the very first Pike River Rendezvous 20 years ago. We want to talk about the event in just a little bit. I want us to talk a little bit more about this chapter of Wisconsin history that this event seeks to, in a sense, recreate and bring alive for people who come to the Pike River Rendezvous. And we want to underscore that this is a free event conceived as something for the whole family to come and experience and enjoy. I would love to have both of you kind of explain a little more about how this fur trading industry worked logistically. I mean, what were sort of the sort of different links in the chain that would ultimately bring these highly prized beaver pelts all the way from the upper Midwest all the way back to Europe, where they were made into these highly prized coats and hats and so on. I mean, how did this industry, in a sense, function, and who was part of it?
We had originally it started at the East Coast, and like Nancy had explained before, they had trapped out all the beaver in Europe, and as they trapped the beaver out in the East Coast, they moved further to the Midwest, eventually out to the Rocky Mountains. A lot of the exploration that happened in this country wasn't because they wanted to explore. They were looking for more beaver pelts in order to supply the demand. The black top hats were the status symbol. You know, like Nancy said, everybody needed a hat because you were outside a lot more than people are today. But these black silk, or not silk, but the beaver fur hats, they were the status symbol. They were the Lexus of the day, you know. Mm-hmm. Show that, okay, I've got some dollars here. And what would happen, you would have trappers. You would have people who would trade with the Native Americans for the pelts. They would be transported by the voyagers who had the big canoes that would travel. Those were the roads. Those were the truckers in those days. We didn't have highways. Most goods were transported in a canoe, either on the Great Lakes or down the rivers, and they would go by ship back to Europe once they'd get to the East Coast. This all continued until the mid-1800s when they figured out how to make the hats out of silk, and at that point we had pretty much decimated the beaver population in this country, and there wasn't any demand for it because they'd found a new method of making the hats.
So this industry then went away, and from the sounds of it, fairly abruptly.
Yes, it ended rather quickly because, you know, first of all, there wasn't any product and there wasn't any demand for it. So you find something else to do for a living.
Right.
And the end of the fur trade actually had a huge impact on the American Indian peoples because they had come to depend on the fur trade for goods such as guns and ammunition and things to ornament their clothing, beadwork and pins, anything metal, metal kettles.
Right.
I'm just kind of visualizing the fur trading post at the museum in cloth, cotton, wool, many of those things that were used for making clothing. And then when the fur trade ended, it had an impact because, you know, these things were no longer as easily obtained by taking a fur to the to the trading post.
Because the trading post would no longer be interested in that fur.
Exactly. But the fur trade was really the first industry in North America. And it got to be very competitive between different European countries. I was recently up in northern Wisconsin and was at a county park in Burnett County where they have recreation of two fur trading posts, one run by the Northwest Company and one run by the XY Company. And they were in very close proximity and in competition with each other to get these furs to send back to Europe. Hmm. So there was a lot of competition even back in the 1600s.
Right. What do we know about what exactly happened here in this neck of the woods with the fur trade industry? Was this a place where beaver lived and were trapped, or were we more along the corridor of transportation in which these beaver pelts would be taken someplace else, or did that sort of change through the course of the years that this industry was in place in terms of what part this section of Wisconsin played in the chain?
It's pretty much anywhere in the country where there was a river or a stream, there were beaver. There's still beaver in Wisconsin today.
In Kenosha County.
In Kenosha County. In fact, I have one in my freezer right now that a friend of mine ran over out by Wilmot. It ran out in the road in front of him.
Oh, poor thing.
But a good friend of mine who does nuisance trapping and that here in Kenosha, he gets calls on a regular basis to go out and trap beaver in the county because they're making a comeback. And what they do to create the ponds that they live in is block up streams and rivers, and people who live out in the county all of a sudden find out that half of their yard is underwater because a little creek that runs by the property has now got a beaver dam on it, and they can be a nuisance. People do not get along real well with wildlife. Our lifestyles are a bit different. So.
Right. So they're still industrious little creatures. And again, what is the point when a beaver builds a dam? What is it needing to do or wanting to create?
It likes still water. And it will build a lodge out of sticks that, you know, they will chew down trees and cut up the sticks and build the dams and build their lodges because they prefer calm water.
As opposed to rushing stream,
yes,
or a babbling brook even would,
right,
not be what they
flowing
want.
Water.
Right. So it's almost like they want to create their own little private lake.
You got it.
Or private pond.
It's protection as well as it makes it easier for them to get around in the calm water.
Right.
It makes it a little easier access to the trees because as it continues to flood, they don't have to be out on the dry land that much.
Right. And so when this fur trade was at its height, it was mostly Native Americans who did the actual trapping of beaver and the skinning of them and the preparing
initially
of the belts?
Initially, it was mainly trading with the Native Americans who had trapped it, but then the Europeans also began to start doing the trapping themselves, kind of cutting out the middleman.
Hmm. So the Native Americans probably got marginalized in some respects, and so this is probably an industry that there were probably some points of frustration, I should think, which make it seem, in a sense, remarkably modern. I mean, we see the way that plays out nowadays too, with breakthroughs in technologies or shifts in public taste or whatever, and suddenly somebody who was in the middle of something very lucrative finds themselves on the outside looking in.
As I mentioned, there were larger trading companies such as the Hudson Bay Company, the Northwest Company, the XY Company, but there were also independent traders. And we have one depicted in the exhibit at the museum called the Courier du Bois. And in our diorama at the museum, he has his birch bark canoe and his American Indian wife. Mm. So often the traders would marry into American Indian tribes to build alliances so that, you know, he would have exclusive rights to trade with her people.
Wow.
So there's all kinds of wheeling and dealing that went on. Probably the biggest actual rendezvous that took place in the Midwest was up at Grand Portage. And, Mike, do you know exactly when that took place? It, probably mid to late summer?
Yeah, I don't remember the exact date or time, but most of the rendezvous and these type of events took place at the end of the winter. They would usually early in the spring or during the summer when the trappers weren't out trapping beaver. The best pelts, of course, were trapped in the winter. That's when they had the best coats on them. So they would trap throughout the winter, and then come spring and early summer, then they would try to turn their pelts into the goods that they wanted, like, say, any of the European-made items. And so typically by midsummer would be the latest. When it got to the Rocky Mountains, they called it at green up. In other words, as the snow melted and the grass started turning green, well, now the traders who came by horseback and mule and that type of thing would have food for their livestock, so now they could make the trip to the mountains and come back. But prior to that, you didn't travel in a lot of areas because there was no food for your transportation. It was like going out west, you make sure you've got plenty of gas for your vehicle because it's a long ways to the
Absolutely.
Next gas station.
It's a long way to any place.
Yeah.
So the Pike River Rendezvous seeks to recreate such a rendezvous as you were just describing up at Grand Portage, which would have been one of the biggest such rendezvous.
Yes and no, because what we're actually portraying is the entire 200 years of the fur trading era, so going from about 1650 to 1850. And we have reenactors that are portraying all of the different time periods throughout. I mean, we have British soldiers that have come riding through on horseback. We have river pirates.
The French soldiers.
And the French.
Because they were here. What we're trying to do, instead of trying to create the atmosphere entirely of the fur trade rendezvous, we've kind of morphed it into, we're trying to bring in pretty much every occupation that anybody would have had during this time frame. We don't have just the trappers and the traders. We have our blacksmiths, we have our tinkers and our silversmiths and our flint knappers and people who are carding and spinning wool. And pretty much it's a hands-on living history to show this is what your ancestors had to do to make a living, to be around long enough for you to be here.
And so this is also some of the industry, in a sense, that would have been, in a sense, back home.
Yeah, or it moved into this area in the little communities, the villages and the small towns. A lot of these people would have plied their trade here, but then some of them would travel out to these different events where they knew there were a lot of people around, and you know they could continue to make a living at it.
It's just fascinating. Of course, this is way before there was any of the means of communication that there are now. I mean, there was not even telegraph, or let alone telephone or radio or internet or anything. I mean, in terms of knowing about these things occurring, and yet somehow they were able to just kind of make it happen. It's so fascinating. So we should talk for a moment about all of the people who, in a sense, populate the Pike River Rendezvous, and I don't mean those who come to experience it, but those who are, in a sense, the presenters. And I really mean specifically here the reenactors who are part of this. First of all, where do all of these people come from?
We have our demonstrators, our reenactors, come from all over the country. Most of them are the Midwest here. They're people that we meet at other events. This is an invitation-only event. There's a lot of these events that happen throughout the country. You pay your fee, you come in, you camp, you do what you want to do. There's different competitions for different things at the events. But Ours is an invitation-only event. We try to locate and invite the best demonstrators we can, the people who are period correct, or they study the history, they do everything accurately, they're willing to stand out here for 8 hours a day and talk to the public and explain, here's why we do this, this is what was done during that time frame. We spend an awful lot of time at historical sites and museums, and it's a work in transition. As Nancy can tell you, the history, we learn a little bit more all the time, and some of what we learn in history is different than what it used to be.
Sure, and this is a vivid way to learn that. Nancy, you were saying when you did the first one 20 years ago, or one of you was saying that there were a certain number of camps that were part of that first Pike River Rendezvous, and I assume there are many more camps now.
Yeah, Mike had mentioned that there were probably about 20, 25 camps at that first rendezvous. We're up to about 150 now, with probably between 300 and 400 reenactors.
Wow.
We just never know how many people are going to show up in each particular camp.
Right. And when we're talking about a camp, what are we talking about? I mean, what sort of, in a sense, unit of measure is that? A camp typically consists, I mean, I know they're all different from one another to some extent, but a typical camp consists of what?
Well, that is your home, basically. It's just like your house. We're creating a canvas village on the island. And one camp may just be a piece of canvas to get you out of the weather and what you can carry on your back, depending on what you're portraying. Another camp may be a piece of canvas, a marquee tent or something along that style that's as big as my house if it's one of the traders, because you have to have room for all of the goods. And a lot of our people who sell period goods or trade the different things, they don't necessarily do this for a living. We have some who do this as a living, traveling around to different events. But then the majority of our traders do this to subsidize being able to do these events, because there's a lot of travel time. Everybody comes at their own expense, and it's not a cheap hobby. You can spend a lot of money getting period correct or actual antiques to have for your demonstrations. So you can spend a lot of money, and a lot of people who have skills like our blacksmiths and things, different people like that, they will sell the product that they make to the visitors or to the reenactors, and that helps to foot the bill of being able to do the next event.
Wow.
So some of the camps, like Mike mentioned, could be as simple as just a piece of canvas to keep you out of the rain, or it could be like a teepee, like what he sets up, or it could be a series of tents because it's a family that is camping
right.
together. So, you know, it varies.
Right. Yeah,
our voyagers, typically the truck drivers of the day, their camp typically consists of a canoe tipped over on its side and a piece of canvas stretched over, and they kind of tuck back in under there. That's how they would have slept during the night.
Wow. And that is how they sleep at the Pike River Rendezvous.
Yes.
What goes into constructing the overall rendezvous and all of these different camps? I don't mean so much like how do you build what you just described. Right. I mean more the layout. In the same way that if you were mounting some huge exhibit at the museum, there would be a rhymed and reason to where things went on the wall, or first you see this and then you walk a little further and then you see this. Is the rendezvous, in a sense, a carefully crafted event in that respect?
Yes.
Or do these camps just kind of spring up wherever they spring up on Simmons Island?
No, we're down there bright and early Wednesday morning, measuring and laying out and putting stakes. We know basically who is going to be arriving, and we set them up. We had to have an area laid out for different things that are going to take place. So we have down by the lake, we have our voyagers who had their canoes. We have our Great Lakes River Pirates. We have them down by the water. We have our military in certain areas, and
the vendors are all
the
in
vendors are
gathered in one area.
The food vendors and our traders are in one area. It's carefully laid out ahead of time because we have a pretty good idea of who's going to show up, and there is a method to the madness. We lay it out in the center of the island where I have my teepee. Everybody who has teepees, we have them set up out there. You can't put a teepee up under a tree. Well, you can if it's a big enough tree and a small teepee, but it doesn't work out real well. Typically, you've got to have them out in the open. Up by the pine trees towards the north side of the island, we put our wigwams, which is what the natives would have had in this area. This would be the homes that they would have. So everything is pretty carefully laid out.
I also know that you have and this is one of the reasons this is an invitation-only event, that you really hold your reenactors to a high bar, a high level of authenticity in terms of what they do and how they do it. Talk for a moment about the kind of authenticity that people can expect to see and experience at the Pike River Rendezvous.
Well, I think, you know, this goes back to the very beginning and what the city had hoped to accomplish with this event. They really wanted it to be a living history event where people could come and be immersed in a particular time period. And that's why it's been important to, I think, everybody on the committee, but particularly Mike and Ernie and Kathy Craik, who are the reenactor coordinators, that we have people that can talk to the public and intelligently convey to people that are coming by, you know, what time period they're portraying, what kind of craft they're doing, and why it was important to that time period. The activity that I oversee along with Jen Edgington from the museum is the family activity area, and we also have the Laughing Fox Tavern, which portrays a tavern from the time period. Now, tavern is very different during the fur trading era than what we think of a tavern today. It was a place where you could get a meal. This was the main source of communication. You were talking about that earlier. This is where you caught up on the local news. It was an opportunity to sleep. Sometimes they were actual structures. Sometimes they were just a tent. But we have family activities that include daily chores. You can grind corn with a corn grinder. You can wash clothes on a washboard. So, again, having that actual immersion, hands-on experience is what we try and achieve with all the camps.
Right. And that's, like I said, a hands-on history. We have the people who not only can accurately demonstrate and explain what they're doing, they're more than happy to invite you in and teach you how to do it, at least get the basics of doing this. If you want to learn how to card wool or spin it, or if you want to start a fire with a rock and a chunk of steel, we have people all over the camp there that will actually let you do this and you know, here's how it works, and we'll show you it's not as easy as pushing a button on a microwave right. If you want to make a meal.
Nothing was as easy back then, was it?
Yeah.
Very, very good. And generally speaking, are these reenactors speaking in first person as though they were living in that moment, or are they or do some of them speak more as, you know, I'm Joe Blow, it's 2017, but this is a reenactment of something. I mean, how many of them, in a sense, tend to immerse themselves completely as reenactors?
A few of them get into character, but most of us don't want to confuse people with the vernacular and the accents and that from the time periods. We do have a few that do, but at this event, for the most part, everybody talks in what is considered common English.
Right. And are instructed, of course, and encouraged to freely interact with people and whatever questions.
Yes.
Absolutely.
That is required. We have ejected people who don't do so. there have been invitations that where we would invite a friend of somebody that was already a reenactor, and oh, they're really good at it, and they show up, and it's like, no, they're not. They won't be back next year. Our rules about period correct and that type of thing, unfortunately, for us that are running it, we have to have the modern cell phones because the island is pretty good size. If there's an issue someplace, of course, we keep them hidden.
Right.
But our other reenactors, if they are on cell phones, that's a definite no-no. Mm. Nothing modern, nothing modern is to be seen in the camp.
Wow. Nancy, I know that one of the things we want to talk about are, because in addition to just kind of walking through the rendezvous and seeing it all, is that there are these things called tent talks that look really, really interesting. I don't remember looking at this schedule before. I don't know if tent talks have been part of this before
or
not.
No, and actually this is the first year. We have a new educator at the Kenosha Public Museums, Jen Edgington, and she has been brought onto the committee in part because we're kind of in a transition phase. None of us are spring chickens anymore, and we want to ensure that this event will go on into the future. So Ernie and Kathy Craik have actually involved their daughter Rachel and son James in part of the planning so that hopefully in the future they will be taking it on. And Jen has got her toe in the water at the museum. And the suggestion she made this year was let's beef up the education just a little bit. And so we are initiating tent talks for the first time this year. They're a little 15-minute presentations that will be done at different camps, and there will be a flag at the camp where the tent talks will be going on.
Oh, what a great idea. So you can easily spot
where
these happen and so on.
Yeah, exactly. And the tent talks, there are probably at least a dozen each day. And they will take place basically on the hour and the half hour. So that gives you time to maneuver through the camp to the next one. But with such diverse titles as the 18th Century Midwife, Flint Napping, Flax Processing, Wooden Shoes, Braided Rug, 18th Century Currency, and one of my favorites, Outhouse Manners, Colonial Ink, What Pirates Plunder For, Fur Trapping, Trade Goods, and English Military. So quite a diverse lineup of little vignettes that will take place throughout the camp.
One of them that caught my eye is making a paintbrush. It's one kind of things you just don't think about. But yes, once upon a time, you had to make your own paintbrush.
Exactly.
And how would one do that back in this era?
Exactly.
So those are tent talks. They go on all day Saturday, all day Sunday as well. And there's a schedule that you can examine if there's something in particular that you want to make sure that you see. And Nancy, I know that also there are a couple of new elements in the entertainment wing, and there's all kinds of favorites who are returning that you probably want to mention as well. But I know you also want to draw attention to a couple of new entertainers that are going to be part of this.
Right. Because this is the 20th anniversary, we wanted to try and have some new entertainment this year. So we are very pleased that the Heritage Dancers are going to be joining us. They will be performing both Saturday and Sunday along with Colonel Webb's Band of Music. And also new this year, on Sunday, we have Jill McCrae, who is going to be doing a demonstration of horse dressage. And this, you know, when we were talking about planning the layout of the encampment, this was provided a little extra challenge to us this year because she needs a performance area of about 30 feet. So we want to make sure that we've got enough space for her and her horse to do their presentation. So she will actually be presenting twice on Sunday, so at 10:15 and then again at 2:30.
Yeah.
But in addition, we have musical performances by Three Pints Gone, storytelling by Andre St. Pierre. There will be games that people can participate in, and of course, the ever popular Pirates Battle on both Saturday and Sunday, where the River Pirates will be storming the beach, and the colonists will be on shore trying to defend the community, and also the amazing Budabi Brother Jugglers. These two young men dress in period and juggle in period. And they are absolutely fascinating and always a crowd pleaser.
Yeah, they're a big crowd favorite. It isn't just juggling. They interact with their audience and get them involved in the act, and there's a lot of humor involved, and they're always a big favorite. We have had them there for several years. Last year they had a scheduling conflict and didn't make it. And a lot of people were disappointed about where they are. So they are back this year.
Wow. So people, we want to make sure they know that for this 20th anniversary Pike River Rendezvous. Nancy, explain where people go in order to come on to Simmons Island and experience the rendezvous.
Yeah, the rendezvous takes place on Simmons Island, and unfortunately this year we were not able to contract with our horse and wagon shuttle, but there will be parking in Kennedy Park. Probably the best access, it would be 44th Street, which dead ends right at Kennedy Drive and Kennedy Park. And then it's just a short three-block walk to the reenactment from there. People can usually find street parking as you come across the bridge on 50th Street. People should be aware that Kennedy Drive and the road down to Southport Beach will be closed off during the reenactment. So please plan accordingly. But the event is completely free. There is no admission charge. There is an entrance on the north end, the west side, right at 50th Street, and then again on the south end.
And we want to remind you that although you're not involved, thank the Lord anymore in the concessions. I mean,
yes.
Some you were happy to hand off.
Yes.
But that there are concessions for sale, and they are, relatively speaking at least, authentic to the period as well. But it's something to eat, something to drink that also enhances the day.
Right. So we don't want to discourage you from bringing money because there will be food to buy, and we have a candy vendor and a popcorn vendor, and then also the traders that are selling all kinds of period things. So it's always nice to take home a souvenir to remember your time in the fur trade.
Sure. But otherwise, it's important to note that, again, that there is no admission fee for this at all. So particularly if you are looking for something wonderful and educational and inspiring for you and your whole family, this is a terrific option. And again, it celebrates its 20th anniversary today, this year, the Pike River Rendezvous, happening Saturday and Sunday on Simmons Island in Kenosha. And Nancy Matthews, Director of Interpretation at the Kenosha Public Museums.
Thank you.
and Mike Elam, one of the organizers of this event and one of the reenactors. I am so glad that we could reconnect today and help you and everyone who's part of this wonderful event say happy anniversary. Thank you for these 20 years that you have offered to the community.
Thank you. And I want to encourage everybody, when you do come to the rendezvous, that there are schedules at each of the entrances. So pick up a schedule because it lists all of the tent talks. There's a map and then a schedule of all of the other activities as well.
Fantastic. We hope a lot of people will seek out the Pike River Rendezvous this weekend. And thank you again for being part of the morning show today.
Thanks, Greg. Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we will preview for you the Starving Artist Fair, which is up in Racine. That's on Sunday. And we want to also note that on Monday, I'm excited to be able to share with you an interview that I'll be recording tomorrow with Mike Crane, who is the director of Wisconsin Public Radio. And he is going to be making his first visit to WGTD tomorrow afternoon. And while he's here, I will be recording an interview that we will air on Monday's morning show. Also next week, although we haven't yet scheduled the recording of it, but I have tentative plans at least to have a conversation with Kathleen Dunn. She is one of the on-air hosts on our sister network, the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, but she is about to retire. In fact, I think her last show is a week from today. And she has kindly agreed to have an interview with me. And so I'm hoping to share that conversation.